From NPR News, this is News in Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Last December, on a cold winter night, an Ecuadorian immigrant walked with his brother through the Bushwick neighborhood in Brooklyn. They huddled together, arm in arm, when three men jumped out of a passing SUV, hurling ethnic and gay slurs, brandishing beer bottles and a baseball bat. The reported attack left one brother brain dead, his accused killers now facing second-degree murder charges as a hate crime. Are incidents like these increasing? The Southern Poverty Law Center reports the number of hate groups has increased by over 50% since 2000. We now turn to Mark Potok, the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project, to tell us more. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Tony. How are you?
Listen, people define hate groups in different ways. So two things for you. How does the Southern Poverty Law Center determine if an organization deserves this classification, and what kinds of groups are we talking about here?
Basically, our definition of a hate group is a group which in its platform statements or in the speeches or writings of its leader says that an entire group of other people, by virtue of their group characteristics, is somehow less. So in other words, a group that says, you know, all black people are criminals, all white people are blue-eyed devils, all the Jews are whatever, is a hate group by our definition.
Are we talking then about the Klan, Nazi skinheads, something different and new perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, the truth is we take in quite a range of groups, Klan, neo-Nazi groups, other kinds of white nationalist groups, by which I mean generally more kind of the suit and tie crowd than you'll find with the Klan and the skinheads. But we also include some very extreme anti-gay groups, some radical traditionalist Catholic groups. These are groups that believe that Jews are evil and so on, murdered God and what have you, and a number of other groups along those lines.
What's driving this growth in the numbers of hate groups? Is it the economy, social forces, a combination of both perhaps?
I think all of those things. During the last 8 years or so, most of the period, these groups have very successfully and almost exclusively exploited the issue of illegal immigration. In other words, every Klan group, neo-Nazi group out there has kind of put aside all their other enemies to concentrate heavily on the so-called threat of people with brown skin coming here to, you know, kind of rape our daughters and destroy our society. That has begun to change in just the last year, especially since last fall, when we had two major things going on, of course, the economy crashing and unemployment in particular getting worse, and then, of course, the election of a black man to the White House. Those things together have really created a kind of perfect storm.
Are the number of hate crimes and the number of hate groups increasing on a parallel track?
It's impossible to know is the bottom line on hate crimes. I say that because the national hate crime statistics that are collected by the FBI are so fraught with problems, reporting problems and other kinds of errors, that every statistician understands that you simply cannot say if hate crimes are going up or down. But what we know is this. The hate crime stats show a range of between about 6,000 and 10,000 incidents per year, going all the way back to 92 when they first were compiled. You know, it's just bounced up and down between those two figures. But quite recently, a couple of years ago, the Department of Justice came out with a very important study which did a very serious analysis and concluded that the real level of hate crimes, both reported and unreported to police, was actually a little over 190,000 incidents per year. In other words, almost 20 to 30 times the number the FBI is reporting. So we don't know if they're going up or down, but we know there are a great many of them.
Our time has run out, but very, very quickly, 10 seconds or less, can you say whether or not you would expect that the new administration, the Obama administration, will tackle this in a new way?
I don't really know how they can tackle it in a new way. It's simply a continuing problem out there that we've got to deal with, and a problem which may well get worse with a black man in the Oval Office. And the economy going essentially to pot.
Mark, thank you very much.
And thank you.
That was Mark Potok, the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project, which published its year-end hate report last week. For years, Howard Witt, the Southwest Bureau Chief of the Chicago Tribune, has kept the spotlight on the town of Paris, Texas, for a string of ugly, racially tinged incidents. Just a few weeks ago, a team of mediators with the Federal Justice Department were called in to lead a public meeting to resolve some of the acrimony. But now there's a pattern of racial hostility in Paris, Texas, including new tension at a local factory. Howard Witt joins us now. Welcome, Howard.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Let me combine two questions into one. I want to ask you to give us a little bit of background here because you broke the Shaquanda Cotton story in Paris, Texas, but also help us understand how race relations have deteriorated there.
Yeah, Paris is a town that's been having troubles for a couple years now. There was a case a couple years ago of a young black girl named Shaquanda Cotton. She was a 14-year-old girl who was pushed a hall monitor at her high school, and for that she was sentenced to up to 7 years in prison by a local judge. The same judge just a few weeks earlier had given a 14-year-old white girl a sentence of probation for the crime of arson for burning down a house. So the disparities in those sentences are what caused a lot of folks to kind of question what was going on in that town. Last year there was a case of a black man who was allegedly murdered. He was murdered. He was allegedly by two white companions who took him out in a truck and ran him over and dragged his body underneath the truck until it was basically dismembered. There's a lot of black folks in that town who believe it was a hate crime and would like to see it investigated as such. The two white suspects are awaiting trial on murder charges in that case. The Justice Department has sent a special team in to try to mediate disputes in that town. They had a meeting there last month, which pretty much erupted into yells and screams between blacks and whites. So that reconciliation effort didn't go so well. And then most recently, there was an incident at a local pipe-making factory called Turner Pipe, where some black employees allege that for many months now they've been complaining without success to their bosses about nooses and racist graffiti and Confederate flags and other offensive symbols that are festooned around the plant. And finally, one of these employees actually filed a formal complaint with the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, a week ago, in which he formally complained about this, and he had photos of all of these nooses and graffiti and such inside the plant. And so the plant officials, once that complaint was filed, said they were shocked by all of this, and they ordered it removed and claimed that they didn't know anything about it. But several of the black employees told me that, in fact, this has been a feature in that plant for many months.
Well, let me stop you there because you've given us a litany of things that are taking place. Let me ask you this. What is the basis of this? Is it just that black folks and white folks in Paris, Texas, do not like each other? Is it a situation where tensions have been exacerbated by the economic conditions? What is it?
You know, I wish I had an answer for that. You know, in many ways, Paris is not that different than a lot of small towns around America, and not just in the South, I would say. You know, I mean, we have this problem in the North as well. Paris has a long history of you know, bitter racial relations. It was the site of several notorious lynchings at the Paris fairgrounds around the turn of the century in the late 1900s. So there's that history to contend with. There's also some real imbalances in the way power is structured in that town. Very few African Americans have any positions of electoral power in the town. So, and it's also located in East Texas, which is a region of the country that is very much deep south and very much, in a lot of critics say it's a place where the civil rights era kind of passed them by. So there's a history of tensions there. But it's not to say that everyone in that town is, you know, is at odds. I mean, there's certainly a lot of folks, both black and white, of goodwill who wish that these problems didn't keep recurring. But there's also a lot of other folks who basically, a lot of folks insist that there's no problems there. It's just outsiders who are stirring things up. And, you know, they claim that if people would just leave Paris alone, then they could deal with their own problems. But
let me pursue that a little bit more with you, because what you have described is a petri dish of racial intolerance so far. But the question would be, how do you come out of that? How does this community heal itself and move together forward, if
yeah,
that's possible?
I think the town is grappling with precisely that question, and the Justice Department is there to try to help them. They have this special unit of the Justice Department, which basically deals with community mediation. They went into Gina, Louisiana last year to try to help folks after the tensions there erupted. They do this routinely, and in Paris they've had several meetings, but like I say, the most recent one kind of ran off the rails because people were just kind of, you know, very emotional and hot-headed. I think that a lot of the hopes that they might be able to talk and tamp things down and, you know, have interactions led by church leaders and such, you know, there was hopes that was going to work until, again, last week this latest problem erupted at the pipe-making plant, which has kind of set things back again. So I don't know if anybody sees a path to you know, reconciliation at this point.
One of the things that we just heard from Mark Potok, the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center, was that hate crime organizations, the number of them is up significantly since the turn of the new millennium. Are you finding the presence of hate organizations in this area?
You know, there's not formal groups that kind of, you know, identify themselves. They don't have the problem of some other towns in the South where there's, like, you know, revived Klan groups and such. I'm aware of the SPLC's research and such. But it's more, I think it's less formal than that, but it's probably no less prevalent.
One other thing I'd like to ask you, because you're a person who has been writing about this and the photographs have been printed and seen around the country. The role of the media in covering this, does it make it better? Does it make it worse?
Well, I think that really depends on, you know, literally what skin you're in, you know. Many of the black folks in that town are very happy to see outside attention brought. They hope that scrutiny is going to force some changes down there. But by the same token, many of the white folks are just outraged, and they think that, you know, this is outsiders meddling in their affairs, and they ought to just get their nose out of their business. There was a local Methodist preacher the last time I was there a month ago who told me that I was no better than a Christ killer. But, you know, you just kind of have to have thick skin.
Howard, thank you very much.
Sure.
That was Howard Witt, the Southwest Bureau Chief of the Chicago Tribune.
Yeah, believe it or not, what kept me alive?
This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. This week on Africa Update, the president of Guinea-Bissau was killed by rebel soldiers, Women of the World Unite in Liberia, and soccer fever gets underway in South Africa. For more, we've got Amira Wood. She is co-director of foreign policy in Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. Hello, Amira.
Hey, Tony. Good to be with you.
Nice to have you with us again. We start in the West African nation of Guinea-Bissau. The country's president, João Bernardo Vieira, was assassinated yesterday. Just a day before, though, the head of Guinea-Bissau's military was killed in an explosion. Now, Vieira has certainly had, Emera, a checkered past in his homeland going back for decades now. Is the assassination linked to the explosion that killed the head of the West African nation's army general?
Well, many say it's been a tit-for-tat there in Guinea-Bissau. But we have to remember, Tony, Guinea-Bissau just gained its independence in 1974. Before then, it was a colony of Portugal, and many say Portugal was probably the poorest of all the colonizers, so there was not very much development going on in all those years of the colonial period there in Guinea-Bissau. So the economy in Guinea-Bissau has really paid the price, and the people of Guinea-Bissau have paid the price for quite some time. But more recently, what you have had is this battle going on between the military and the civilian leadership in the country. And, you know, I have to say, Tony, when you see, especially now, U.S. foreign policy in Africa leading by engaging and establishing relationships with militaries, we are creating a new trend here, whether it's Mauritania and now Guinea-Bissau, where these militaries with the resources and the weapons and the training from the U.S. often are gaining strength and gaining power. And so what you had really was a blatant attack and assassination by the military as they are gaining their strength. They are asserting that strength, using that power oftentimes against civilians and against their own people. So I think we're tipping the balance here in U.S. foreign policy, privileging militaries, helping militaries gain more strength. And instances like Guinea-Bissau are what I'm afraid may be one of many where we see the repercussions.
Very interesting. You know, the military has supposedly indicated since the assassination that it would be willing to abide by the rule of law and whoever the next leader is. Are you buying any of that?
Well, the proof will be in the pudding. We have seen many instances when military leaders come on board and they say, oh, we will follow the Constitution and the rule of law, and then we see that absolutely does not happen. In this instance, we have seen already today that the head of the parliament, Piera, has taken over as the interim leader. That's a step clearly in the right direction. It is following the Constitution, but we will have to see what happens. And again, Guinea-Bissau is off the coast of West Africa, just on the other side of the Atlantic. And you have seen now a real privileging of the military, particularly as the U.S. Department of Defense advances its counter-narcotics efforts in West Africa. Guinea-Bissau has become a place of transshipment of drugs. And right. So that effort to continue to strengthen U.S. ties to Guinea-Bissau, you know, under the guise of fighting narco-terrorists, essentially, could well continue to privilege the military, which will mean continued instability in Guinea-Bissau for some time to come.
All right, let's move on to another topic. March is International Women's Month, and to mark this, Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf and the President of Finland are together holding a women's colloquium in Liberia next week. What are the main themes?
Well, this is an extraordinary thing. It's bringing together women leaders from around the world to essentially applaud, commend, and encourage greater women's political leadership, not only in Africa, but around the world. So you have Africa's first woman president and the first woman president of Finland hosting this gathering, which, you know, for a country coming out of 26 years of war, Liberia, you know, hasn't celebrated an international convening of this type really since 1979. So it is a platform to help encourage women's rights, women's legal rights, women's economic rights and economic empowerment, but also engagement of women in political processes. So there are multiple themes along the way, but all of that is to strengthen the power of women, both in formal political office and in social movements and civil society organizations in Africa and around the world.
I wonder how they're going to accomplish that. I know that in Liberia in particular, the political power of women has been seen on a number of occasions, including the peaceful protests against Johnson. Taylor.
Against
I said Johnson.
Taylor,
I'm sorry,
yes,
that's Taylor.
You know,
excuse me.
Yeah.
How are they going to effectuate this? I know it's a big word for something simple. How are they going to make this happen?
Well, it's quite simple. Women are already there. You know, as you talked about, it was women, the women's peace movement in Liberia that, you know, organized daily marches for peace and for justice in Liberia during the Taylor period. It helped bring about the end of the Taylor period. Beautifully chronicled in the movie Pray the Devil Back to Hell now in theaters here in the U.S. I think it's more of those stories that have to come out that talk about the dynamism, the resilience, the creativity of women that are real, you know, kind of in the vein of the Harriet Tubmans and the Ella Bakers. You know, they are real fighters for justice and for peace, and they are all around the continent and all around the world.
Speaking of fighters, let's go into South Africa, where a name from the past is reemerging in a very strong political context. I'm talking about the former wife of Nelson Mandela, Winnie Madikizela Mandela. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly.
It's now, pretty close,
okay,
right?
she's back. How is that happening?
Well, you know, she hasn't gone very far. You know, the level of popular support for Winnie Mandela has been extraordinary. She is seen as very much a leader from the anti-apartheid days and very much one that has reflected the will of the people. So of all the political dances that have gone on in South Africa, Winnie Mandela has remained not that far from the forefront of the public consciousness. And, you know, I think it is a sense not only of Winnie Mandela, but of women in general. We're continuing this theme here, I guess, Tony, mm-hmm. because if you think about South Africa, you know, we should also remember that half of their cabinet, you know, 50% of their cabinet is made up of women. Over 30% of their parliament, you know, that would be comparable to Congress here, which has just 18% women, but close to 30% in South Africa are women. So when you think about women involved in various levels of political processes. Winnie Mandela is probably the most well-known, but there are many women at the forefront now in South Africa that are emerging both in the current administration and will well be part of administrations to come post-elections.
Well, our time is out for Africa Update. It's been very informative. I want to squeeze one thing in here really, really quickly, Mira, and that's it. World Cup coming to South Africa really quickly. People are excited, aren't they?
Oh, it's a fun thing, and it's amazing. The World Cup is being hosted by Africa for the first time. South Africa is hosting in 2010. The tickets went on sale already, and you hear all of this excitement around the continent of people trying to figure out how to get to South Africa and how to get their hands on these tickets. So it's extraordinary, and it will be quite a wonderful opportunity for Africa to show its strengths in this 21st century.
Amira, thank you very much.
All the best. Thank you, Tony.
Amira Woods is co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. She joined us from our headquarters in Washington, D.C. Now to the East. Celebrated hip-hop artist and poet Kanan grew up in war-torn Somalia, but he's got more street cred than your average gangster rapper. He fired his first gun at 8, and at 11, he saw a gunman slaughter 3 of his friends. Eventually, Kanan fled Somalia, and now he is making music about his experience. His new CD, Troubadour, blends hip-hop vibes with African and rock rhythms. How did Mandela get the will to surpass the everyday when injustice had him caged and trapped in every way? How did Gandhi ever withstand the hunger strikes and all? Didn't do it to gain power or money, if I recall, is the gift. I guess I'll pass it on. Mother thinks it'll lift the stress of Babylon. Mother knows. My mother, she suffered blows. I don't know how we survived such violent episodes. I was so Kanan, welcome to News and Notes.
Thank you for having me.
How difficult was it to come up to become a musician and an artist growing up in Somalia during the very difficult days that you did while you were there?
You know, that was difficult for everyone. And so I kind of shared and the piece of the pie of all that is struggle that is coming from these kinds of political breakdowns when the center can't hold anymore. And so I'm just a part of that group of people, and eventually that's really what fueled my music. That kind of a curse ended up being a blessing to a degree.
Do you ever wonder why you, growing up in Mogadishu, a place you've already described as the meanest streets in the universe, why you turned the direction that you did? You're not out with the pirates out in the Gulf of Aden. Do you ever think about how you made the choice you made?
I got fortunate, you know, to be able to channel some of my own internal crises, you know, like the crisis of being faced with these immeasurable amounts of difficulties that the people I come from face. And then having absolutely no venue of expression for it and no one to listen is really kind of a hard thing to kind of survive. And so I was really just fortunate to have found melodies and poetry and music, which has let me release that kind of, you know, problem externally.
On your new CD, Troubadour, there are a number of very interesting songs on there. One of them is I Come Prepared. I made the list this year, I'm on a roll. You ain't no East Africa rock and roll. You don't know what time it is, like your clock is old. You ain't know we all packing like the block is sold. How could he be from the deepest, darkest of zero to become king of New York like De Niro? And he ain't even from New York, that's what's weird, yo. But where he's from, they just ret-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. So come now, don't you try to play the hero. The idea of the song is we are survivors, and so we come from this, and to have emerged on the other side is really something that takes courage, and it takes fortune and humor and all of it mixed up. And so what I'm saying is I Come Prepared is kind of saying, well, hey, you know, I couldn't have been any other way. You know, you have another song on here. It's the first cut. It's called ABCs, and
yeah,
it reminds me of a really a profound combination of message, of music, of beat and lyrics, and it seems to be sort of along the lines of what you're talking about with I Come Prepared, isn't it?
Yeah, ABC is just kind of like one of those moments, you know, where I'm using like a children's choir to tell my story. I have so many different influences and inspirations, and I feel like there's never a reason to disguise those influences. I think ABC is just like a classic Kanan song in the sense that it gives you the conflict of should I dance or should I think, you know?
Does suffering make for more realistic rap lyrics and provide more credibility the more you suffer?
Well, I think those who do not seek credibility tend to usually have credibility. I think that struggle does fuel good perspective.
Well, you know, I ask that because I wonder, I've heard comments that you've made to some extent denigrating certain parts of American hip-hop culture and music, and wondering if you think that it's necessary or if it's because of your experiences in Somalia that what you say has greater weight than someone who's rapping in America about something of lesser consequence.
Well, the truth is that I do respect people's struggles. You know, my gunshot wound is the same to you as the headache that you have. Everyone is entitled to voicing a struggle. What I was commenting on some of my songs and some of, you know, what you might have heard on the interview is really just about the glorification, the Hollywood version of violence that is in the genre that sometimes people put me in, that I'm sometimes a part of. But just because we come from the real ugly version of violence, it's hard for me to respect it when it's the picture-perfect type of violence that is in hip-hop.
Let me ask you about your personal life a little bit. You and your mother escaped from Somalia in 1991, and what I understand is a pretty amazing story. You were in the States for a while. You now live in Toronto. The difficulties in Somalia continue. They're on the news every day. Are you torn about where you should and want to be with your life with regard to where you were born and where you are and what you are doing now?
Yes, sometimes I am. There is no true consolation for those sort of things. When you're on the phone with your cousins who are your age and aunties and so on, and they don't have the natural right of a human being, none of them have plans for the next day. They can't really. You just might be killed. And so when I'm hearing these things on a day-to-day basis, it's hard for me to sometimes, you know, I feel like I can never really do enough. And that's part of what my music comes from, kind of this survival guilt, you know.
I asked my students if they had a question for you after listening to your CD, and here's one from Juliana Silverstein. She says, what is your inspiration?
My inspiration is the continuous things that happen in the world, which either surprise us in grace or surprise us in the way that they seek destruction. These sort of extremities are truly what inspires me. Nothing in the middle ever inspires me. No mediocrity. If it's bad, it's the worst which inspires me. And if it's great, it's the greatest.
Kanan, it's a pleasure having talked with you, and I hope to get to meet you at some point. Good luck with the CD.
Thank you so much. I really, truly appreciate that.
Somali hip-hop artist and poet Kanan. His latest CD is Troubadour. He joined us from our studios in New York. From the west side of the Chi-town, like Twista, with a flow so sick it'll blow you to bits. It'll show you the glitz and the gold and the wrists and the boats and the fish. When I blow them a kiss, look bloke, you must be talking a piss or taking a piss. Are you talking a fish or the girls in the boat exposing it? I could have been from NY. Like next on News and Notes, post-racial, colorblind, fairy tale. We'll hear how some white bloggers think race relations could change in the age of Obama. Fresh case jewels and I'm riding.
I stay cool, and I got border troubles like them essays, fool. I could have been from the dirty like Eitan or MIA. I could ride an invisible motorcycle and go, hey, storm like the hurricane. And I don't mean hey, baby. I'm from Africa where they say Canaan.
I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. Maybe you're looking to improve your overall health and appearance. Maybe trying to add a few years to your life and lower your chances of heart disease, diabetes, or cancer. If so, this next segment might be just what the doctor ordered for you. It's about what we eat and how we cook. Bryant Terry is the author of Vegan Soul Kitchen. Now wait, I know that sounds strange, mixing metaphors almost, but Terry says the vegan lifestyle and loving soul food are not mutually exclusive, and he's written a cookbook to help folks navigate this cultural culinary landscape. He joins me now. Bryant, welcome to News and Notes.
Thank you, Tony.
You know, I'm going to be honest with you. It sounds like a contradiction of terms, vegan and soul food. So let's start with some definitions, okay? Vegan, that's what exactly?
Veganism is the avoidance of meat, poultry, seafood, eggs, dairy products, sometimes honey. You know, that's pretty much the dietary kind of like undercurrents of the veganism. But then there are also, you know, ethics to the philosophy. People have, you know, clear ethics about animal rights, environmentalism. So there are a number of things that move people towards veganism.
All right, and I'm going to ask you this, and I mean it in all sincerity. When you say soul food, what exactly do you mean?
Well, I think what I mean when I say soul food is probably different than what most people imagine when they think about African-American cuisine or soul food, as it's popularly termed. And, you know, often people imagine it as the deep-fried foods and fatty products and sweet desserts. And while that's one part of the cuisine, it's much more rich, complex, and diverse. And that's one of my main projects of this new book, is really helping people to broaden their understanding of what African-American cuisine is.
Now, you say in the introduction to the book that it could just as easily have been titled Citrus Collards with Raisins, Recipes and Autobiography. What did you mean?
Well, Edna Lewis, who is the late Edna Lewis, was a chef from Virginia. She moved to New York City, where she opened a restaurant and really popularized Southern cooking in the Northeast. And she's one of my heroines. Her second book, The Taste of Country Cooking, reads more like a memoir that is interspersed with recipes. And so she's a big inspiration. So my work largely draws from history and memory. And, you know, I talk about my family's history, my own culinary journey, and I include that in my recipes, you know, following or including a head note before the recipes that talks about the historical, autobiographical, political significance of each dish that I compose.
Now, we're going to talk about some of those recipes in a minute, but before we do that, I want to ask you this. Many people, Bryant, no matter what ethnic group they belong to, often do not change their diets until their doctors force them to. But is there a way to ease into a more healthy diet that doesn't send shockwaves to your taste buds?
Yeah, I think, you know, one thing that I always remind people of is that over the past 3 to 4 decades, most people have suffered from the results of an industrialized food system. You know, the industrialization, mechanization of food, the globalization of agriculture has pretty much affected ethnic cuisines across the board. And I think one thing that we have to do is reclaim the origins of the food, you know, and that's what I'm doing in Vegan Soul Kitchen, is saying that, look, I want to present a book that provides a much-needed intervention in a cookbook genre that's oversaturated with books that have animal products. And the focus on this book is fresh, seasonal, sustainable produce, fruits, vegetables, you know, good food that I think so many of us don't have in our diets because we're eating processed, packaged, industrial food. So I really want to place the focus back on that. And I think, you know, we can all think about ways that we can bring the focus back on those kind of, like, good food origins in all of our ethnic cuisines.
All right, let's talk about some of the things that are mentioned in here. You have a page where you call it the top six good eats. Is, you got to rewind me. Citrus collards with raisins redux, agave sweetened orange, orange pico tea, sweet sweetbacks salad with roasted beet vinaigrette, Uncle Don's double mustard greens and roasted yam soup. Here's another one. Cajun Creole spiced tempeh pieces with creamy grits. And here's the other one. Open-faced barbecue tempeh sandwich with carrot cayenne coleslaw. Let's talk about that last one, because when you say barbecue, you know the taste buds automatically go to ribs or chicken or steak. This isn't going to taste like that, is it?
I hope that it would satisfy anyone who likes the flavor of deep, rich, tomato-based barbecue sauce. I grew up in Memphis, and, you know, we like to slather that thick red tomato barbecue sauce on whatever, ribs, chicken. And I decided that for people who might want to avoid animal products or try something different, I wanted to use tempeh, which is a dense, delicious substitute that a lot of vegetarians and vegans use for their protein. And so my parents, you know, they're some of the harshest critics of any food, and it got past them. They loved it. So I think pretty much it could win the approval of anyone.
Let me ask you this. Is it an attempt, some of these kinds of recipes, is it an attempt to mimic the taste of meat, or is it an attempt to get people just away from the thought and taste of meat and dairy entirely?
My goal is not to mimic the taste of meat. I do use some traditional kind of protein supplements that vegetarians and vegans use, but mostly it's about the fresh produce. Like you said, the citrus collards with raisins. I took this staple of African-American cuisine that's traditionally eaten as a savory dish, and I wanted to reinvent it, rework it, remix it, giving it kind of a sweet, modern twist. So, you know, and for me, the because when people hear that, they're perplexed. Citrus collards with raisins. But the Thompson raisins, you know, the citrus, the fresh orange juice, they, in addition to giving it a, you know, kind of a sweet-leaning variation of this traditionally eaten savory dish, they serve as a metaphor for the way that I envision African-American cuisine, more creative, cutting-edge, and refreshing as we enter the 21st century.
Brian Terry, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you, Tony.
That was Brian Terry, author of the book Vegan Soul Kitchen. He was at the studios of the University of California, Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism. Throughout history, African Americans have used humor as an escape and as a way to express the black experience in America. This January, the Sundance Film Festival screened a documentary that explores the evolution of black comedy. The film, Why We Laugh, traces the genre's roots from the early days of Mantan Moreland to the modern comedic stylings of Chris Rock. Daryl Littleton wrote the book Black Comedians on Black Comedy. The documentary Why We Laugh is based on that book. He joined me here at the studios of NPR West. So, Daryl, welcome back to News and Notes, man. Nice having you around again.
It's always great to be here, Tony.
So now we're talking about the documentary that was based on your book, Black Comedians on Black Comedy. And it looks at the history of black comedians in this country.
Exactly.
Talk about the beginnings of black comedy in the modern era.
Right. Modern era, because, of course, we started with slavery.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that was our communication, that and music, because we couldn't speak the same language. But the first recognized superstar in black comedy was Burt Williams. There were minstrels before him, but he and his partner, George Walker, were the first black comedians to do, number one, a film. They did a motion picture back in 1901. They were the first ones to do that. Also, they had hits on Broadway before anyone else, and they also had hits in London, stage plays.
The most popular radio show in the history of radio was Amos and Andy, and it was done originally, as you know, by white actors playing black characters, and then when it transferred to television, they turned those white characters into black actors.
Right, because there was a team called Miller and Lyles. And they were a great black face team, and they were black men. They had went to a station in, I believe it was WGN in Chicago, and they brought the idea of Amos and Andy to them. They said, no, we're not interested. actually, they were interested. They just didn't want to do it with black men. So when these guys came, Gosden and Carell, who were white men, who were black minstrels, who put on the black face, they came. The station gave them the idea and said, hey, you know, what about this? And they said, wow, that sounds great. That's how they became Amos and Andy. The original show was called Sam and Henry, but they had to change the name. Once the contract ran out, then they went ahead and called it Amos and Andy.
The comedy of black comics has evolved from Burt Williams to Kingfish and Amos and Andy up to Dick Gregory. And so by the time Dick Gregory comes along, we're in a whole new realm, are we not?
Yes. Dick Gregory is the first recognized, and he'll say it, the first black comedian to be able to stand flat-footed and just deliver comedy. You had other comedians back then, but they always had to do a little song or a dance or whatever. Sammy Davis had to dance and sing and then tell jokes, same with Pearl Bailey and some of the other comedians. But Dick Gregory was able to go on television, sit down on the Jack Parr Show, and sit on the couch and actually have a discussion, and that had never happened in the history of television.
When I make Time magazine, Monday morning, it's Jack Parr on the phone. Dick Gregory? Yes, this is Mr. Parr. How come you don't want to work my show? I said, I just don't want to work. Why? I said, because the Negroes never sit on the couch. It was a long time. He said, well, come on in. You can sit on the couch. They said they got so many phone calls that night that the circuits blew out at NBC New York. And it was interesting. It was white folks who had seen a black person for the first time in a human conversation.
This is the 60s, right?
Yes, this was 1961.
So now black comedy is evolving still. You have Bill Cosby coming around about now.
Right. Bill Cosby owes his career actually to Dick Gregory because Dick opened the door and Bill was the second black comedian to gain national recognition.
Now, Bill Cosby's brand of humor has lasted and lasted him well ever since. There have been others who have come and gone whose humor has been high and low, depending upon what the circumstances were. Why has Bill Cosby's humor been able to withstand the test of time?
Because Bill Cosby's humor is timeless. It deals with general universal themes such as family and caring about your fellow man and so forth. It's not rooted in the fact that he's black. It's a colorblind comedy.
My mother kisses every child. Well, just come here and kiss your grandmommy. Grandmommy just love it to death. And my children think that my mother's the most wonderful person on the face of this earth. And I keep telling my children, that's not the same woman I grew up with. You are looking at an old person who's trying to get into heaven now.
At the same time that Red Fox was out there, this is, again, 60s, 70s, Bill Cosby's out there, Dick Gregory is out there, there is a woman, a black woman, and as far as I know, she was the only one operating at that level at that time. I'm, of course, talking about Moms Mabley.
Right. Moms Mabley is recognized as the first black female comedian. And she was taken out on the road by a team called Butterbeans and Susie. They gave her her first break.
Why is it that we haven't had the numbers of black female comics that we had for men in terms of the success? I mean, we do have Whoopi Goldberg, obviously, Wanda Sykes is contemporary, Monique, contemporary comedians, and there are others, I'm sure, but it would seem relatively few in comparison to the numbers of men.
I can speak from this from experience because I live with a black female comedian right now, and it's tough for her and it's tough for a lot of her peers because when you are attractive, number one, it's harder to get work. It would seem easier, but it's harder because everybody from the doorman to the promoter to other comics, they're jamming you and they're not really caring about your comedy. Whereas when you have other women, such as more portly women who go with the mammy role, it's a lot easier for them. Or if you have women that go from the Mom Mabley tradition, it's a little easier for them. Also, due to the fact that comics, by large, have to do a lot of road work. And the road is a whole different game for women than it is for men.
Now, your documentary spends a great deal of time with Richard Pryor, the genius that he was.
Anyone here remember them switches? Yeah. Right? You used to have to go get off the tree yourself and take them leaves like that. I see them trees today. I will kill one of them. Stop the car and say, wait, hold it. Yeah, listen, yeah. Mm-hmm. You ain't never gonna grow up.
Talk briefly about his comedy, what made him so special, what made him so different from all of the others, including Bill Cosby, although in the beginning he sort of patterned his act after Bill Cosby, didn't he?
Yeah, he was a Cosby clone. He had the mannerisms, the action, the voice inflection, everything of Cosby. He had his epiphany in 1969. He went to Las Vegas, and he was standing on stage. And at one point, he just stopped his act and said, you know, what the hell am I doing? Because that just wasn't him. He was successful. He was funny. But at a certain point, a comic has to be true to themselves.
There are two comedians that we have not discussed who I think are part of this conversation. One is the late Bernie Mac, whose television show was an award-winning, groundbreaking kind of black comedy. And the other is Tyler Perry, who seems to be the profit model right now for black comedy.
Right. In the sense of Bernie, yeah, Bernie was a great comedian in my book. And I always want to thank Bernie, because Bernie Mac was sick when I interviewed the book. And so he could not verbally do an interview with me. But his assistant said he wants to do it. He wants to participate. Can you write the questions and we'll write the answers back? And so he did that even in his state at that time. So I love Bernie Mac. Now, as far as Tyler Perry is kind of like the Shelley Garrett of the modern era. Shelley Garrett used to do these stage plays back in the 80s where he would go around doing the same thing Tyler Perry did, the gospel plays, and he would always attract the church audiences. And so there's a division in the sense of appreciation for Tyler Perry. If you're really into that kind of stuff, you know, the stage plays and the broad humor, which borders on vaudeville, then he is the man.
Is he turning the clock back on black humor?
To a degree. What he's doing is keeping some of the old tradition of black comedy. Somebody said this, and I think it was Dick Gregory that said this in the documentary. See, Amos and Andy looked bad to us back then for black people because that's all you had. But now, when you've got a president who is black and you've got, you know, an attorney general who's black and heads of major corporations, then just like Tyler Perry's humor does have a place, because that's not the only representation we have, so should Amos and Andy have a place nowadays. So there's room for all of those traditions, because we're not a monolith. Black people, we're very diverse. Some of us like pickled pig's feet. Some of us can't stand it.
Black Comedians on Black Comedy is the book, and the name of the documentary is?
Why We Laugh.
Appreciate it.
Thank you, Tony.
That was author and comedian Daryl Littleton. He joined me here at the studios of NPR West. That's our show for today. Glad you could join us. To listen to the show or subscribe to the podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org.